Okay, Jim, I'd like you to introduce yourself for me, please.
I'm Jim Miller, Vice President and Chief Economist with Growth Energy in Washington, D.C.
And what are some of the other titles that you've held in your background, Jim?
Well, I've been Undersecretary for Farm and Foreign Agricultural Services at USDA. I was a Senior Policy Advisor and Analyst for Agriculture and Trade with the Senate Budget Committee for a number of years. I've been the Chief Economist for the National Farmers Union and the Vice President for Government Affairs at the National Wheat Growers.
Well, Jim, I wanted to talk to you about a couple of things, but let's start with the farm bill, since you've had experience, I guess, with the previous two farm bills, and now we have a situation that probably no one has ever seen before in Washington with a farm bill. I'd just like to get your opinion of what do you think about what's happened with this farm bill, and what do you think is going to happen going forward?
Well, I think it's obvious to everyone. The process for developing the 2013 Farm Bill is just a tremendous mess. And I think that's very unfortunate, not just for the farmers that want the certainty, but the Farm Bill is a lot more than just farm programs. It includes the conservation title, a trade title, a credit title, a rural development, and then, of course, the nutrition title, which is one of those issues that's at the midst of all the controversy and all the difficulty in trying to get this bill across the finish line.
Well, and we were talking a little bit about what do you think is going to happen at this point going forward, because we have a deadline. September 30th is when the extension runs out. What happens when that extension runs out?
Well, the immediate impacts are going to appear to most people to be relatively minor. Because for the commodity provisions of the Farm Bill, for the nutrition provisions in the Farm Bill, really nothing happens and won't happen for several months. Actually, on the commodity title, the first impact really is after the first of the year, when if nothing happens and Congress takes no action, so-called permanent law goes into effect, and that will have an immediate impact on dairy provisions. For grains, the impact is even several months further down the road, because you won't have a new crop harvest. The nutrition program will go on as long as there is an ability to fund the government. So those programs are, going to continue at least for a time. The problem comes with a number of the other titles, where the authorization to operate certain conservation programs, our foreign market development and export initiatives will lose their authorization. The mandatory provisions, the permanent type provisions under rural development will go away. So that creates, I think, a tremendous amount of uncertainty and some things that are extremely important, not just to farmers and ranchers, but certainly important to rural communities, and I think very important to the nation as a whole as we try to, dig out of this recession. And agriculture's been leading the effort to advance the economy in this country, and that could be a real setback.
As far as the nutrition titles, the differences in the nutrition funding between the Senate at $4 billion and the House nutrition title at $40 billion, that's a pretty big difference. Do you think they can come together on this?
I think it's extremely difficult, and I think the action that the House took, first of all, in splitting the nutrition title from the rest of the Farm Bill, I don't think is very helpful to those of us that are interested in farm bills and what that means for rural America. But I think it's also made it extremely difficult to achieve the kinds of compromises that have been worked out over decades in terms of trying to balance the needs of all the multiple interests that are involved in farm policy. I do not envy those who are likely to be appointed to the conference to try to reconcile these differences. I think it's going to be just extraordinarily difficult, with no guarantee that at the end of the day, if they can bridge those differences and find those compromises, that this bill is still not going to be subject to some actions that could undermine those efforts down the road.
Well, even before they passed the nutrition, the House has kept putting off they're appointing their conference members. So the Senate appointed theirs right away, but the House now still says they've still got to go through all these other steps.
Some of it is procedural and is required, and I think we all have to appreciate that. But some of it certainly appears that they've been stalling, particularly after they spent all of 2012 talking about doing a farm bill, and then at the end of the day failed to even bring one up. Then in 2013, the House Agriculture Committee passes a farm bill, and it fails. And then we end up with this mess where we've separated the bills. I do expect at some point the House will appoint conferees. And then the question is, okay, what are going to be the instructions to those conferees? And what kind of negotiations are going to occur in the interim that might bridge this gap? But it's I think it's a very difficult situation. And given some of the other issues that confront the Congress, things like how do we fund the government, not just for the next couple of months in terms of a short-term continuing resolution, but what are we going to do for the whole of fiscal year 2014? We have we are going to exceed our debt limit authorization sometime in October. That's going to be another critical issue, and these are things that involve how the government interacts with everyone in this country. It involves how does the government ensure the full faith and credit of the United States? I mean, these are very big issues, and the House and the Senate have to deal with those. And so that kind of, in a way, pushes the farm bill to the back burner, which is extremely unfortunate because we've been there before. It's not a fun place to be.
Still. Well, let's talk about what you're doing with growth energy, and particularly with the RFS is the main issue, continuing to support the RFS to keep it going. What do you see right now as the major challenges within Congress? I mean, because obviously big oil and everybody wants to, they constantly are challenging the RFS, but they can't really do anything about it. And it's going to be up to Congress and or if EPA grants a waiver. We've got at least those two particular challenges. What are you looking at there?
Well, first of all, we know that EPA has sent its proposed rule for the renewable fuels volumes for 2014 to OMB to be reviewed. And then once OMB signs off on that, then that will go out as a proposed rule, open for some period of comment, and then a final decision will be made. And we believe, and we've consistently said, that we think the RFS law is exactly fine. It has done a tremendous amount for rural America. It has done a tremendous amount for consumers in this country. And EPA, under that law, has significant flexibility and authority to make adjustments. And they have indicated, first in the action that they took in their final announcement for 2013, and at the same time indicated that they were going to take a serious look at making some adjustments for 2014. We think that's the way it should be done. We're very fearful that if Congress starts to try to amend the RFS, they're responding to some very short-term circumstances and what could have some extremely long-term implications, not only for the renewable fuels industry and certainly for the significant investments that people are beginning to make in terms of things like advanced biofuels, cellulosic ethanol, and that type of thing. And it could tremendously undermine those efforts. But we're also fearful that it could undermine what is clearly being demonstrated as a way to save consumers dollars at the gas pump. And ethanol is trading now at about 80 to 90 cents under the price of gasoline. So even on an adjusted basis, it is saving consumers money. We think there's tremendous opportunities to do more. But if they continue to create uncertainty about the RFS, and that has been big oil's issue for a long time, and they've gathered some allies in that, that uncertainty means that we're going to continue to be subject to the monopoly that they have and the stranglehold that they have over the American consumer rather than giving them choice at the pump.
Well, maybe with all the other things Congress has to do that they won't get around to the RFS. But I understand that, is it Debbie Stabenow has asked CFTC to do an investigation as far as RINs is concerned? Is that correct?
Yes. Chairwoman Stabenow and Senator Grassley have joined in a bipartisan effort requesting the FTC to basically take a look at the oil industry's control over the retail sector. And that, of course, has a big impact on this whole issue of renewable identification numbers, which in our view is somewhat of a non-issue. It's a zero-sum game, and it's a situation that the oil industry asked for when the RFS was passed because it provides them some flexibility. It also provides EPA a fairly easy way to monitor the compliance with the renewable fuel standard. But there has been what appears to be some gaming, both in terms of speculation as well as in hoarding of RINs. There were an adequate number of RINs out there for 2013. I think it is interesting that the price of RINs skyrocketed just about the same time that the House was holding hearings on the RFS. And then once those hearings were over, once EPA made its announcement, we've seen the RIN market collapse, and it's now trading at about a third of what it was trading for a few months ago. That seems to me to be a bit odd.
Well, getting back to the Farm Bill and the energy title in the Farm Bill, let's talk a little bit about that. What if there's differences between the House and Senate, what Growth Energy would like to see as far as funding and titles in the programs in the energy title of the Farm Bill?
Well, there is a very major difference between the proposal that the Senate approved and what the House has approved. And while the programs are very similar, it is really a question of the funding mechanisms. The Senate has provided what are called mandatory dollars. In effect, it has said there will be a certain amount of money spent on the various provisions within the energy title, the REAP program, BCAP, all of those things that it has reauthorized. The House took a different approach. It said we're going to reauthorize the programs, but we're going to make it subject to appropriation, which means every year you would have to go back, get money from the Appropriations Committee in order to fund these programs. Well, given the state of the government's finances, given the pressure with sequester and everything else on appropriated dollars, so-called discretionary dollars, it's almost impossible for me to believe that there is a way you're going to get the Appropriations Committee to fund those programs as new demands on their very limited budgets while they try to maintain some semblance of funding for their more traditional programs, which include agricultural research, rural development, a certain amount of conservation spending, credit programs, all of those things. So we're very supportive of what the Senate Agriculture Committee did and what the Senate validated with its large bipartisan vote in passing that bill to continue these programs and to provide the so-called mandatory dollars so that there is certainty in terms of how these programs will operate over the next several years.
Let's tie the two together, because one of the big issues with the RFS is not being able to get enough cellulosic and next generation biofuels in that were required under the RFS. And the energy title has helped fund a lot of the research, ideally, to get us into that. So really the two are tied together.
Well, they are tied together, and I think it's somewhat interesting in that the challenges that the renewable fuels industry as a whole faces is really one of market access. How do we penetrate the market? How do we give consumers choice? We're not mandating that consumers use any particular blend of fuel through most of these programs. So what we're saying is we want to give them choice at the pump and let them decide, and we believe we can compete if we get market access. And that's true of starch-based, corn-based ethanol. It's also true of cellulosic and advanced ethanols that are coming down the road. Then the issue is, under the RFS, the amount of corn-based ethanol that we would be producing in the future is basically capped at around $15 billion a year, and we're relatively close to that. We're producing about 13.5 billion gallons now. The challenge has been on the cellulosic side, And yes, we have not met the expectations that existed in 2007 when the RFS2 was passed for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is we went through the most serious recession since the Great Depression of the 30s, and literally, as everyone knows, the credit markets throughout the world were frozen. It was very difficult to raise money to make those investments. Those investments are occurring now. We're going to see commercial level cellulosic ethanol plants in operation beginning in 2014. And we expect that if we have stability in the program, if we have the market access to utilize the product, the opportunities for both grain ethanol and cellulosic ethanol are only going to improve in the future. But it really takes maintaining the RFS and providing those market opportunities, and then we're willing to let the consumer decide.
Very good. Here at the New Holland American Ethanol Producer Club event, I'm Cindy Zimmerman.